My name is Pete Nanov, and I'm a student co-supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. General William Tecumseh Sherman once said that war is hell, perhaps hinting that legal and moral principles have little or no role in controlling the nature of war. In today's world, such total war is not tolerated. Strict laws of war have been enacted governing the conduct of war. First and foremost, civilians are not to be the target of warfare. The recent war in Gaza and the war on terror have reinvigorated debate regarding the level of justice that is associated with war. Although Hamas's rocket attacks on Israel arguably triggered the conflict, the number of civilian casualties resulting from Israel's attack climbed steadily throughout the three-week campaign. Recent figures estimate that the war resulted in the death of 1,300 Palestinians, both militants and civilians. The global community has criticized both Hamas and Israel for their tactics and use of force in this conflict. Reports suggest that Hamas used civilian buildings and shelters as shields for their operations. Israeli troops responded by destroying such installations and, consequently, killing and injuring civilians. Israel has since pulled troops out of Gaza. Our guest tonight, Michael Walzer, is a professor emeritus of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Professor Walzer has published books on a wide variety of topics, including political theory and moral philosophy. He is also currently co-editor of the political intellectual quarterly Dissent. Professor Walzer has published 27 books and over 300 articles and has served on the faculty at both Princeton and Harvard universities. At this time, I would like to ask that the sound be turned off on all cell phones and any other electronic devices. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a short question and answer session. Out of courtesy to those who may be hearing impaired, and because we are taping this event, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to be passed to you before speaking. Thank you for your cooperation, and now please join me in welcoming Professor Michael Walzer.
Thank you. I began writing this talk in 2006 during the Lebanon War, the second Lebanon War. And it was written for me. It was just a private meditation, which I've now turned into a lecture dealing with. Most of my examples will come from Lebanon, but I'll also talk about Afghanistan and Gaza. And I will I will try to respond to some of the things just said in the introduction. People get killed in wars. Soldiers get killed, and civilians too. Not only when they are deliberately targeted, but also when they are trapped in a combat zone or living in the immediate vicinity of an army bunker or a munitions factory that is under attack, or when they are used as cover by non-state militants. They are bystanders who are standing too close by. We mourn the soldiers who die in battle, but we are horrified by civilian deaths. The horror seems universal. We find it expressed in all the major civilizations and in all religious traditions. We call civilians innocent because they are not involved in the fighting and because they have done nothing or done very little for the war effort. Even though they may be fervent supporters of the war, it's the doing that counts when we think about innocence in wartime. And that word is especially applicable to the children in the civilian population who have done nothing at all. Children have an obvious, palpable, insurmountable innocence. The easiest way to impress upon us the awfulness of war is to show us pictures of the children killed and injured in its course. Sometimes those pictures are used to persuade us to condemn a particular war, one that is being fought right now and that should be stopped right now because these children have been killed and because many more like them are at risk. We all saw pictures like that, used in that way, during the 2006 Lebanon War, and we have seen them even more recently brought to us from the Gaza Strip. Curiously, we are rarely shown pictures of dead or wounded children from Afghanistan, though the war against the Taliban is not very different from the wars against Hezbollah and Hamas, and many civilians have been killed. Those pictures make the best possible argument. I can't imagine anything more persuasive. It is a difficulty, though, that this is an argument that can be made about any war, whether it's a war of aggression or a war of self-defense, whether it's fought to conquer another people or to rescue them from conquest, whether its purpose is to defend an empire or stop a massacre. Children die in all those wars. The only exceptions are wars that consist entirely of tank battles in the desert or naval battles on the high seas, and there aren't many wars like that. And some of the wars that are not like that are just wars, which means that one side is fighting rightfully. From a moral standpoint, perhaps this is a war that should be fought because of the character of the enemy, whose success is a prospect more fearful than war itself. What if stopping the fighting right now means victory for a conquering army, or the triumph of a government bent on mass murder, or the survival in strength of militarist or terrorist forces that fully intend to renew the fighting? Should we still be persuaded by the pictures? It's because of its terrible cost in innocent life that war is abhorrent. That's why we must do what we can do to avoid it, to find some other means of dealing with whatever it is that some generals and some politicians tell us only war can deal with. We must do what we can to find another way, but not everything that we can. For we can always surrender or appease the enemy or postpone the fighting. I can imagine arguments for appeasement and postponement. Sometimes, perhaps, those are the prudent things to do. But sometimes, certainly, they are not the right things to do. Sometimes, to put the issue exactly, doing those things will produce even more dead children. Sometimes, it's morally necessary to fight. And then it's also necessary, this time in the sense of inevitable, that civilians will die and that we will do some of the killing. For very good reasons, this prospect is increasingly difficult to accept. There was too much killing in the 20th century. One could learn different lessons from this fact, but the dominant lesson that has actually been learned is that we should avoid killing altogether, if we possibly can. After World War I, a kind of pacifism, the pacifism of exhaustion and fear, spread through Western Europe. And since World War II, a fierce aversion to war, indeed to any use of force, has played a prominent part in the politics of most European countries. In the United States, media coverage of recent wars has brought their brutality into brutally clear focus. Even Hollywood, which once gave us movies about heroic soldiers fighting in sanitized battles, has turned to a harsh realism and now forces us to watch the actual unbearable carnage. We have learned to be skeptical about military glory. This aversion to war is especially strong on the left, which is why it's stronger in Europe than in the United States. That hasn't always been true. Leftist revolutionaries once turned all too easily into crusading warriors. The French gave us the first example of this in the years after 1789. The Red Army marching on Warsaw in 1919 is the classic 20th century case. But more ordinary leftism is ordinarily peaceful, hostile not only to war but also to preparation for war. It was in part a leftist politics that determined the reluctance of France and England to rearm in the face of the Nazi threat in the 1930s. That last point is not much to the credit of the left. But the general aversion, it seems to me, is. It's a good thing to stand against militarism. It's a good thing not to be eager to fight, so long as we understand that sometimes it is necessary to fight or to be ready to fight. As it was in the 1930s, no one who grew up as I did in the next decade can doubt that necessity. And if it's necessary to fight, then it is necessary to kill, which is the hardest thing. How should we think about killing in war once we accept its possible or its sometime necessity? During the Lebanon War, and then in Afghanistan, and now in Gaza, critical arguments about killing were based mostly on the idea of proportionality. So I'm going to begin with that. It's a common idea, which we know best from domestic law. It appears, for example, in the laws relating to intruders and thieves. It figures in our conception of self-defense. You can't kill an intruder who obviously poses no threat to your own life. The response to domestic aggression must be proportionate to the danger. That's not an easy doctrine to apply in the actual circumstances of a hostile encounter. The distinction made in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, between daytime and nighttime intrusions is meant to provide a rule of thumb. Because darkness is more dangerous than sunshine and light, there is no blood guilt for killing a thief who comes in the night. But that's obviously not a reliable guide. And the doctrine is even harder to apply in the circumstances of battle, which are always dark, and where the proportionality rule extends, as it doesn't do in the domestic cases, to collateral damage. We can kill the thief only if he is immediately threatening. We can kill enemy soldiers even if they are far from the battlefield. We cannot kill the thief if doing so would put innocent bystanders at risk, but we can do exactly that in the case of enemy soldiers, so long as the number of bystanders is proportional. But proportional to what? All the difficulties that arise once we cross the line into the world of war are evident here. Proportionality in wartime can be, and most often has been, a darkly permissive principle. As when we are told that this number of civilian deaths, and it might be a very high number, is not disproportionate to the value of military victory. But its most recent uses have an exactly opposite purpose. To insist that this number of civilian deaths, and it might be a relatively low number, is disproportionate to any possible military achievement. At the end of the first week of the Lebanon War, Kofi Annan made a curious and revealing statement to the UN Security Council. He began carefully by saying that Israel had a right to defend itself. It had, after all, been attacked. And so it was fighting a just war. But, he insisted, its response had been disproportionate and excessive, and so it wasn't fighting justly. He never provided a measure for proportionality or gave any indication of what number of dead civilians would not have been disproportionate and excessive. Presumably, the number in his mind was very low. It was only 10 days later that he acknowledged that Hezbollah was firing rockets into northern Israel from, I'm quoting him, from positions located in the midst of the civilian population. And so it was itself putting large numbers of civilians at risk. Were those numbers disproportionate and excessive? Annan didn't say. His politic position, as Secretary General, he has to have a politic position. His politic position that Israel had a right to fight, but only within the limits of an undefined proportionality, presents the dilemma of justice in war very clearly, but not very helpfully. What is the appropriate measure? And once we know the answer to that question, how many deaths does it allow? What number of civilian deaths is not disproportionate to the value of destroying, say, a Hezbollah base in Lebanon, or a Taliban base in Afghanistan, or a Hamas missile launching site? These are frightening questions. And the people who talk about proportionality, or mostly about disproportionality, rarely make any serious attempt to answer them. I won't pretend that I know how to answer them. I'm not sure that there's anything like a precise answer. Still, we have to worry about the questions. According to the doctrine of reprisals, as it appears in just war theory and in international law, and this may be what Annan was thinking about when he first spoke, the measure is precise. In the case of the Hezbollah raid, 8 Israeli soldiers were killed and 2 were captured, so the proper response would have been to kill 8 Hezbollah militants and capture 2. Any greater number would violate the proportionality rule. And then the captives could have been exchanged, 2 for 2, which is the way exchanges ought to go, given the equal worth of all human beings. And the dead could have been buried, and that would be the end of the story. In the future, Hezbollah would be deterred by the knowledge that its violence would be exactly matched by the violence of the Israeli army. But maybe not. Maybe it wouldn't be deterred. The political leadership and the military organization responsible for the original raid would be intact, undamaged, ready to strike again, perhaps with greater force. And the strictly symmetrical response might be no deterrent at all. Maybe the right measure for a proportionality argument is the value of destroying or significantly reducing the enemy's capacity to repeat or expand its attack. But once you leave behind the moral arithmetic of 8 and 2, how do you calculate? How do you conjure up the necessary numbers? And this leaves out of consideration the rocket barrage on the Galilee that preceded the raid in 2006 and the arsenal of rocketry that Hezbollah had accumulated, which clearly had no purpose in internal Lebanese politics. Might the appropriate measure be the value of reducing the arsenal, or, in the Gaza case, of preventing the smuggling in of the next generation of rockets? And since these rockets are intended for use against cities and have been used that way in the past, the measure might be the value of protecting very large numbers of civilians against future indiscriminate attacks. What number of civilian deaths in Lebanon or Gaza would the proportionality argument permit now? Too many. Too many. Indeed, much too many. And that should lead us to worry about the structure of the argument. If one accepts the proposition that sometimes it is necessary to fight, then one must also accept the proposition that sometimes the stakes are high, else there would be no necessity. And then proportionality is not an effective limit. If one denies that the stakes are high, then proportionality is very effective. It makes fighting pretty much impossible. There must be middle positions between these two, but they are very hard to mark out. The argument works better on a smaller scale, in more local settings, where the issue isn't the value of winning the war, but the value of hitting this particular target. Here, for example, is a Hamas rocket launcher and a team of men operating it on a city street. They have just fired, let's say, a rocket at Ashkelon. They can be hit by an Israeli missile, but the attack would endanger a number of nearby civilians. What number is not disproportionate to the military value of destroying the launcher and its operatives? In cases like this, I'm pretty sure there are limits. 100 civilian deaths seems clearly out of line. So do 50 deaths. So do 30. But what about 15, 13, 5? What about 20 civilians at risk with a probability of 30% that they will be killed? A probability of 20%, 10%? Once again, I find these questions frightening. Now I can imagine rough answers. I can't imagine confident answers. And it seems to me that there are other questions that must be answered first. And here is my major argument this evening. In our judgments about justice in warfare, responsibility comes before proportionality. When we know who the responsible agents are and what their responsibilities are, the questions about proportionality may turn out to be less difficult to answer, and sometimes they won't have to be answered at all. Let me illustrate this argument with an example, a famous example, from World War II, and then I will return to the contemporary cases. In early 1943, the Allies discovered that the Germans were operating a heavy water plant in Vemork, Norway, an operation vital to their effort to produce an atomic bomb. It seemed, this was certainly realistic, it seemed very, very important to destroy this plant. But it was located in the center of a small Norwegian town, and it could not be attacked from the air, given the aiming devices available in 1943, could not be attacked from the air without endangering Norwegian civilians. The Germans had not deliberately put the plant there. That's just where it was. That's where they had found it. Now, the proportionality argument would certainly justify an air attack. Indeed, if every civilian in the town had been killed, the toll would not have been disproportionate to the value of stopping the Nazis from acquiring atomic weapons. But the Allies felt that it was their responsibility to avoid civilian deaths if they possibly could, and to take risks for their own soldiers in order to do that. And so they decided to send commandos to destroy the plant. And there's a wonderful movie about the commando raid. The first raid failed with the loss of 34 British soldiers. A second attempt succeeded, to everyone's amazement, without loss to the British. Two Norwegian underground fighters were captured by the Nazis, who had helped the British, were captured and killed. Now, the responsibility argument is easier here, I suppose, since the inhabitants of Vemork were friendly civilians. Still, it's important that responsibility in the eyes of Allied decision makers so clearly trumped proportionality. Later in the war, heavy water production was restarted in Vemork and security greatly tightened. And then, after debates in London, there were still debates, the plant was bombed, and 22 civilians were killed in the attack. I don't know if the Allies paid reparations to the families of those civilians, which would have been the responsible thing to do, but it was a more impressive acceptance of responsibility that led 34 soldiers to give their lives in an attempt to avoid the air raid. Now consider again the case of the rocket launcher on a Lebanese or Gaza city street. The city street location was deliberately chosen to make any response to the rocket attacks morally difficult, or even better, to make sure that the response would be condemned around the world. Civilians were at risk, some were sure to be killed in the counterattack. These civilians were not literally human shields. They were not being held in front of men firing at Israeli soldiers, but they were being used in a similar way. And the first responsibility for their deaths falls on the militants who were using them. But then shouldn't we insist that these groups undertake the necessary proportionality argument? What number of civilians at risk is not disproportionate to the value of firing rockets into Israeli cities? But the question can't be asked. Firing rockets at cities rather than at military targets is a war crime. It has no value that can be measured against the number, against any number, of at-risk civilians. In this case, the responsibility argument displaces the proportionality argument. The displacement is less radical on the other side. The Israelis also have responsibilities vis-a-vis at-risk civilians, as the Norwegian case suggests. They must do everything they can, including putting their own soldiers at risk, to hit the rocket launcher and its operatives, and not the nearby apartment buildings. But what if, after firing the rockets, the Hezbollah or Hamas operatives drag the launcher into the basement of one of those buildings, where they store it, along with a supply of rockets for future attacks? Assume that Israeli soldiers cannot get to the building or can only get to it at great cost, not only to themselves, but to civilians along the way. Their counterattack must come through the air. Then intelligence becomes critically important. They have to do the best they can to discover how many civilians are in the building and apply the proportionality rule. If the number is not disproportionate to the value of destroying the launcher and the rockets, they may bomb the building. And if not, not. If the number is too large, they are prohibited from doing that. And if they don't hold off, they cannot escape responsibility for the resulting civilian deaths. Both sides would then share responsibility. So here, proportionality is doing some work, even though I still can't tell you what the necessary numbers are. Nor, I think, can anyone else. The calculations are very rough and always contestable. Sometimes in the aftermath of an attack, one side or the other will make a persuasive proportionality argument. Sometimes both sides will make equally unpersuasive arguments. But if the number of likely civilian deaths is persuasively now always disproportionate to the value of destroying the rocket launcher and its operatives, or the storage room and its contents, so that in the Lebanon and Gaza cases, Israel could not respond at all to the rocket attacks, then the prohibition on attacking collapses. Now even disproportionate counterattacks are justified, and assuming the necessary carefulness, which I'll come to in a moment, responsibility for civilian deaths falls only on Hezbollah and Hamas, because it is a central principle of just war theory that the self-defense of a people or a country cannot be made morally impossible. And so the more successful Hezbollah and Hamas are in hiding among civilians, the less useful the proportionality argument is, or the less limiting it is. The more effectively civilians are used as shields, the greater the danger to which they are exposed. and responsibility for the exposure falls on the people who are using them. We can now recognize this as a common situation with regard to non-state fighters. I don't think that it matters from a moral standpoint whether the civilians agree to be used by these fighters or resent the position into which they have been put. In Lebanon and in Gaza, it is clear that some civilians fall into each of these categories, and the case is certainly the same in Afghanistan. Necessary carefulness is still a crucially important limit, but it has to do with responsibility, not with proportionality. I argued this a long time ago with regard to the doctrine of double effect, which some of you may have heard of, which provides or claims to provide a systematic account of both responsibility and proportionality. It holds that when the intended target of a military attack is, say, an army base or a tank factory, injury to nearby civilians, even if it is certain to occur, is morally acceptable so long as the injury is not intended, is not one of the goals of the attack, and so long as it is not disproportionate to the value of destroying the target. If the injury is unintentional and proportional, the attackers are not morally responsible for it. That's the standard version of double effect, but it makes things much too easy for the attackers. All they have to do is not intend the civilian deaths they know they will cause. It seems to me, instead, that there must be a second intention to match the second collateral effect. First, the soldiers carrying out the attack must, indeed, intend to hit the military target. And second, they must intend not to kill nearby civilians. And this second intention must be manifest in the planning and conduct of the attack. The attacking forces must take positive measures to avoid or minimize injury to nearby civilians. Indeed, it's morally necessary to take such measures, even if it seems likely that the number of deaths caused by a careless attack would not be disproportionate to whatever the relevant measure is. Attacking forces must shield civilians as best they can, period. That is their moral responsibility. So consider now the official Israeli defense of the bombing of an apartment building in the Lebanese town of Qana. You may remember this incident. It was the worst incident of the Lebanon war, in which 29 civilians were killed. Once again, I could find similar examples in other wars in Afghanistan, say, where air attacks on the Taliban have resulted in many and sometimes too many civilian deaths. This is the official defense, which was denounced by many Israeli commentators. The strike against the building was carried out in accordance with the policy of the general command. This policy determines that IDF forces are permitted to open fire against suspicious structures within villages whose inhabitants have been warned, and likewise upon structures in proximity to locations from which rockets have been launched toward the State of Israel. Now, this is clearly a bad policy, not only because proximity is much too vague and permissive a term, but also because of the line about warning. Warning the inhabitants of a village that they may be attacked and that therefore they should leave their homes, that's a good thing to do, but it does not free the attacking forces from the need to make reasonable efforts to see whether people have in fact left. Any attack upon suspicious structures without such efforts is wrong, whether 29 civilians die or 12 or 1. As the American Army learned from the attempt to create free fire zones in Vietnam, where we repeatedly warned villagers to leave, some civilians never leave, despite repeated warnings, because they are old or sick, because they are taking care of the old and the sick, because they are afraid that their homes will be looted, or because they have to bring in the harvest or look after domestic animals. So it is never right to make fire free. Now, and that argument has nothing to do, as I've just indicated, with proportionality. It is a straightforward responsibility argument. Now, why is it that in discussions of civilian deaths in wars like those in Lebanon or Afghanistan or Gaza, the proportionality argument is commonly given priority over the responsibility argument instead of the other way around? It seems to me that there are two reasons for this. First, given our natural aversion to civilian deaths, it makes for an easy critique. Any number of deaths can plausibly be called disproportionate to, the phrase implies, as I've been arguing, some kind of military political measure, but the actual measure is our aversion, which makes disproportionality into a simple and compelling anti-war argument. But once again, this is an argument that works against any war without regard to its justice or injustice. The second reason is more complex. Proportionality without responsibility makes it possible for critics to condemn the military force that causes the deaths, whether or not it is responsible for them. When non-state organizations fight against state-organized armies, responsibility may lie on either side, almost certainly on both sides, but it is always the army that will cause the greater number of the deaths called disproportionate. Proportionality arguments are therefore favorable to the non-state side, while responsibility arguments are necessarily discriminating. So let me just briefly consider how the idea of responsibility guides our judgments of America in Vietnam, of NATO in Kosovo, and Israel in Lebanon. In Vietnam, Viet Cong guerrillas fought from within peasant villages, exposing the inhabitants to American counter-fire. And I argued at the time, I'm afraid I'm old enough to have argued at the time, that when Americans fired back, assuming that they aimed as best they could at the guerrillas, it was the Viet Cong that was responsible for the resulting civilian deaths. In the case of the free fire zones, by contrast, we were responsible, as we were for indiscriminate bombing of villages and for the effects of Agent Orange, the chemical defoliant, on the rural population of Vietnam. Responsibility was the crucial issue. Indeed, though I worked in the anti-war movement for several years, I don't remember proportionality arguments playing any part in our campaigns, except in the case of the famous reductio ad absurdum, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. That's disproportionate. In the Kosovo War, the Serbs claimed that NATO's bombing of Belgrade caused a disproportionate number of civilian casualties. But given what had already happened in Bosnia and given what the stakes were in Kosovo, that didn't seem a plausible claim, and no one paid much attention to it. With regard to Kosovo itself, however, the crucial arguments were only about responsibility. NATO insisted that Serbian forces were exclusively responsible for the murder and expulsion of civilians, but some critics of NATO, I was one of those, argued that the refusal to send in ground forces early on meant that NATO also had some obviously lesser responsibility for the carnage. Had NATO gone in, its high-tech army would have killed many people, but saved many more. a stark example of a hard, but I think necessary, moral decision. In the Lebanon War, the Israeli army caused most of the civilian deaths, but some of the villages it attacked were being used by Hezbollah as bases for rocket attacks on Israeli cities. So the greater part of the responsibility for civilian deaths in those villages lay with Hezbollah, as did the greater part of responsibility for the war itself, which began with a rocket barrage and a Hezbollah raid across the international frontier. Israel was responsible for deaths caused by unjustifiable bombings, like the Qana raid, and for the use of cluster bombs in the last days of the war. But again, it shouldn't be the proportionality arguments that guides our judgment of those deaths. They were wrong whether or not they were disproportionate. In Vietnam, Kosovo, and Lebanon, it is the balance of responsibility that is morally determinative. This primacy of responsibility over proportionality is commonly recognized in the case of jus ad bellum, when we ask who started this war. But it is also important in the judgments we make about the conduct of war, who first put these civilians at risk. So let me return to the beginning of my argument. People get killed in wars. Soldiers get killed, and civilians too. And we need to figure out who is responsible for those deaths. If we do that, and if we assign responsibility clearly and firmly so that our judgments have political consequences in public opinion and UN resolutions and intellectual debates and ultimately in diplomatic initiatives and policy decisions, we will have done as much as we can to hold down the number of dead civilians. And we will also have confronted and acknowledged the painful truth that some of those deaths, terrible as each one of them is, have been brought about by soldiers fighting justly. Thank you. So I'm happy for questions, but also for arguments. And I guess I will, you want me to recognize people? Oh, okay.
Hi. An observation and a question. I served in the Israeli military between 82 and 85 in Lebanon. And I think a lot of the questions about whether or not war is just and how one makes these decisions often depends, as you suggested, on the level of field intelligence, how much we know about the battlefield as it is happening. In most cases in urban warfare, when you look through the sights at a building or at a street, you don't see all that much. It is very, very difficult to evaluate how many people will be affected by anything that you do. The situation in Gaza was a bit different because the intelligence was so much better. And I think a lot of casualties were avoided because of that. Not that they didn't happen, of course. But the question is here, just how applicable are these larger questions when the soldier, the sergeant, and the lieutenant don't have the information to be able to make those sorts of decisions? The second question is, what do we do when the opposing side places a very high value on dying to be a martyr? When kids are taught from a young age that is actually a good thing to do. How do we assess life, the value of life, if one of the parties assesses it different than in a different tradition?
Okay. I didn't expect easy questions. I certainly agree. Intelligence is important in all wars. It's especially important in wars of the sort that we're now seeing between a state army with massive firepower and non-state militants who hide among or are sheltered by the civilian population. Intelligence becomes very important, and sometimes it just isn't available fast enough, and that's when I suppose mistakes are made. When you are responding instantly to rocket fire, and sometimes the Israeli responses were literally 30 seconds or a minute, because if you didn't respond that quickly, the people launching the rockets would be gone. When you're responding that way, you're responding blindly. You're just it's the machinery targeting the firing post. But when you're responding, as in the apartment house in Kana, where you were responding to stored rockets, I think there is time and there is a requirement to use air surveillance to try to make some educated guess about how many civilians are in the building, and you have to do that. When you're warning civilians in advance, you have to find some way of just looking at the area and to see how many people are leaving and how many are not leaving. As I say, the evidence from Vietnam is that a lot of people don't leave, and so that makes warning insufficient. I don't know. I suppose I'm too much of a product of the Western Enlightenment to understand people who want to be martyrs or even to believe that there are a lot of them. And I think in fighting against religious zealots, you have to fight as if they are like you. There's a story that I was reading in a book about some of the recent wars of some of the Islamic zealots in Afghanistan, some of the Arab zealots who came into Afghanistan and were held with great contempt by the Afghanis because they invited death. They were more eager to die than to fight, and the Afghans who were fighting thought that this was not the way to carry on a war. I guess if you encounter people like that, then they are going to get killed, and you can't feel moral anxiety about that. But so far as you can, you have to treat these people like you expect to be treated. I mean, that's the golden rule, and it still applies.
So I had a question about, you said you designed this talk primarily about Lebanon, and I wanted you to say maybe a little bit more about Gaza and whether or not the responsibility argument you were using with respect to Hezbollah and the Lebanese didn't work quite as well with respect to the Palestinians, to the extent to which mobility in Gaza isn't quite the same as mobility perhaps would have been in some of the other places that you've discussed. And so, for instance, if there were to be pamphlets dropped all over Carlisle tonight saying that Carlisle would be bombed tomorrow, I would certainly not be in Carlisle tomorrow, but that might not be the case for a lot of the people who were in Gaza. So I wonder if the responsibility argument is as persuasive in the case of what recently happened in Gaza as you think it might be in some of the other cases you mentioned.
Well, I don't think warnings are sufficient in any of the cases because, as I said, even when people can leave, they don't, or significant numbers of them don't. So, but I agree. In Gaza, there was for many people no place to go, so the warnings were of were of no use. But then you have to try to think about how the rockets keep coming. How do you fight back? There has to be a way to fight back. You can't be attacked by people who claim that it's morally impossible for you to respond. So if the rockets keep coming, then at some point the civilians who are being used are exposed to greater risk. And I don't see any way of avoiding that. So, there may be diplomatic ways of avoiding it, but within the compass of a military operation, I don't see ways of avoiding it.
I've got a question concerning, you mainly talked about killing civilians and that being, whether or not that was proportionate, but concerning soldiers fighting soldiers, for example, in the first Gulf War, we had United States Army mainly conducting airstrikes, which was a very professional army, very professional Air Force, against retreating Iraqi columns, which were not on par with our military force. At what point is that unjust, even though you're fighting soldiers?
Right. Well, as you know, it was finally stopped because American generals wanted it stopped because it was they called it a turkey shoot, and they didn't think that a turkey shoot was consistent with, well, leave the laws of war aside, it wasn't consistent with the honor of a soldier. It wasn't consistent with the code of a soldier. If you are certain that the war is over, that this retreating army is not going to be reassembled, and is not going to fight again, then you have to stop. You have to stop as soon as that becomes apparent. Since we had already decided that we were not going to march to Baghdad in 91. I think the attack on the retreating army was probably wrong, although we do know that the Republican Guard, which was not part of the elite units which were separate from the regular army, the Republican Guard was reconstituted and was used quite brutally to repress revolts in the Shiite South and the Kurdish North. So if we missed the chance to destroy the Republican Guard, that may have been a mistake.
How much of a responsibility is there for the people defending themselves to make more accurate targeting systems and weaponry in terms to lower the number of civilian deaths?
Well, yes, there is that's part of the responsibility of any military force, that it wants first of all, the most accurate weapons it can produce, and it wants the best trained soldiers. And now, obviously, we have to begin training soldiers for the kinds of wars we are likely to be fighting in places like Afghanistan. And these are not the same as wars fought on conventional battlefields. And as I said, we need to improve in intelligence. There was recently an incident reported in the New York Times from Afghanistan where an American Army unit attacking what it thought was a Taliban, a group of a Taliban militants, killed some 30 people and announced that they were militants who had been killed, and then the Afghan government claimed that only two of them were militants and all the others were civilians. And then it turned out that this army unit had been sent in because the army thought an attack from the air would be too risky for civilians, and it was better to send soldiers in who could get close enough to take aim, which is, even though the risks to the soldiers were greater than the risks to pilots from the air. So we were doing the right thing, but possibly with such bad intelligence that we ended up doing something awful. So, yes, there are large responsibilities for designing weaponry, for training soldiers, and for organizing intelligence services.
Hi. I lived in Israel for 3 months when I was in high school, and there was a really bad bombing in a mall in Netanya, and I was wondering what you would consider to be an appropriate response to something like that, which appears to be an act of war, but to which you have a responsibility not only to your people, but to the people of another group that might not even be existing in a nation.
Yes, well, you're asking how you respond to terrorist attacks, which are not coming from a territory like Gaza, where Hamas is in control. They're coming from territory where conceivably no one is in control, or even where you're in control, but not in sufficient control to stop terrorist attacks. It's what we faced after 9/11. The right way to respond to terrorist attacks is through police work and intelligence and secret operations of designed to get the necessary information. So the war on terrorism is really a metaphor. Because most of what's involved is police work, which has different rules than the rules of war, and which haven't been worked out with great clarity because nobody has really been thinking about that, although I suspect in Israel people have been thinking about it for some time. And sometimes the war on terror may take the form of war, as it did for us in Afghanistan, because the Al-Qaeda was a partner of a government. It was operating from a territory. But when terrorists are not operating from a territory, it's going to be exactly the kind of police work and clandestine work that we're just beginning to learn to do.
I have a two-part question. First, I would like to ask how strictly you can adhere to the innocence of non-combatants on a couple specific examples. First, you have child soldiers who, as you said at the beginning of your lecture, children have always evoked innocence. So what exactly do we handle how do we handle this from a moral perspective when now we have no choice but to treat children as combatants? And then also, what about people traditionally considered non-combatants, the people, say, working in a munitions factory? You have a vested military interest in taking out those people that are making the bullets that are perpetuating the conflict, that are killing your people and your soldiers and civilians. And then the second part of my question, I'd like to address the issue of responsibility with warnings. I don't think it's fair to say that 100% of the burden of responsibility would lie on the military forces, because even if people have a very legitimate, morally compelling reason to stay, they have to know what's coming, and they have to understand that they could get themselves killed staying there. So shouldn't they have at least a small part of the responsibility for staying if they're killed?
Okay. Well, the easiest part is the munitions factory. Workers in a munitions factory have always been regarded as combatants. They've been assimilated to the class of combatants, because as are the people who transport military supplies. A train carrying military supplies can be bombed, a convoy. It's important to say that we can only attack munitions workers in the factory. We can't attack them when they're at home with their families. Then they are assimilated to the class of civilians. And some just war theorists have attempted much more fine distinctions, which will probably make you smile. But Elizabeth Anscombe, the Catholic English philosopher who was one of the great people writing on this subject, once argued that workers making munitions were combatants, but workers making K rations were non-combatants, because the soldiers needed the munitions as soldiers, but they needed the K rations as human beings. And so she tried to draw that line. You couldn't bomb a factory making food for the army. And that makes some sense if you... we have to draw a line, and that's one way of drawing the line. The child soldiers of Africa, this is a frightening phenomena, and they are soldiers. They have to be treated in battle like combatants, even if they are drugged and crazy and childish all at once. When captured, you might treat them differently than you would treat. You would want to, to send them to school rather than to put them in a prisoner of war camp. You would want to treat them differently, but on the field, they are unhappily like soldiers. I suppose you can you can argue that it is a good thing to give warnings, because then some people can leave, and those who don't leave will know that they're accepting a risk. But as I said, sometimes there are such good reasons for accepting the risk that you want to make a major effort to avoid killing them, even though they've disregarded the warning.
You mentioned earlier about how there were situations when the Israeli Defense Forces had to respond immediately within minutes to a rocket attack from Gaza, and then how there are other situations where the response time is allowed to be much longer, where planning needs to take place. How do you differentiate or decide what the attack qualifies as a long-term planning response or a short-term, sometimes irrational response?
Yeah, that's a kind of tactical question you'd have to ask a soldier, someone involved in planning these attacks. When do you have time? But we do know that there are times when there's time. And whenever there's time, we want the Army to take advantage of the time and to learn as much as they can before they attack. And sometimes, when they really don't know, but there is a risk that the number of civilians is very large, as with perhaps an apartment building that hasn't been evacuated, then maybe you don't attack that storage room, even though there are rockets in it. You look for another storage room or another place to direct your fire. So long as there have to be places. As I said a number of times now, there has to be a way to respond. But there are always choices being made. If you talk, I've I have never been in an army, but I've spent a lot of time talking about these questions with soldiers, and they are very aware of the kinds of choices they have to make in battle situations. And so what you want to do is to elicit from them an account of a response exactly to your question. When is their time?
We have time for one final question.
Thank you, sir, for laying out a very logical discussion on the proportionality and the roles of responsibility. I was wondering if you could comment on the what I would consider the elephant in the room we haven't discussed. All of these are subjective judgment calls, whether it is proportional to the population that is receiving the attack or the population that believes it is defending itself. From your research and your experience, could you give us your comments and your perspective about who rightfully gets to make that subjective call and the second and third order effects about who has access to the media and to public forums and who does not?
Okay. Well, I don't accept the notion that these are purely subjective judgments. I wouldn't have had to write a book. I wouldn't have written a book if I thought that was the case. I wrote a book to try to frame, to try to organize and systematize our judgments and to provide some objective criteria for making these judgments. Proportionality judgments are very, very difficult at the margins, but we can make them in gross terms. We can say, no, that's too much. We have to understand that they're not, it's not the Hatfields and the McCoys. Proportionality isn't a matter of symmetry. It's not the it's not a family feud in Kentucky where the Hatfields kill three McCoys and so the McCoys are allowed only to kill three Hatfields and anything more is disproportionate. That's not what war is like. Proportionality is a forward-looking judgment. It's a judgment about what the value is of destroying this military target. If you don't destroy it, what damage is going to be done in the future by these soldiers or by these weapons? So it is indeed a hard judgment, but you can accumulate evidence, and knowledgeable people can argue about the evidence, and there will be a gray area where within which they will disagree, but there will also be judgments of yes and no, with which they will all agree. And the responsibility arguments seem to me even more clearly objective. When German tanks were sent into battle, this is a story, maybe the French made it up, but were sent into battle in World War I with hostages strapped to the tanks. And the French could only stop the tanks by killing the hostages. Those hostages, that was the responsibility of the Germans who strapped them there. That's not a subjective judgment. We know that that's who was responsible for those deaths. And I think most responsibility judgments will have something like that kind of hard objectivity. I'm willing to go on if you, there are a couple of people with their hands up.
If you have the energy.
One or two more? Yes, what about, take the.
My question is, to my understanding, you said that Israeli response was a just war for them. What about the Gaza side? What about the Hamas side? I think since they are not a state, it might not be a just war for them, but the framework of the war have changed in recent years. So I just want your comment on the other side. Can you justify for them?
Well, I don't think the rocket attacks at cities, rockets aimed at cities, every rocket with the hope, I mean, these were primitive rockets, so most of them didn't do a lot of damage, but every rocket was sent with the hope that it would hit a school or a hospital or an apartment building. I don't think that can be justified. And I don't think it's justified by the occupation of the West Bank, although I'm strongly opposed to the occupation of the West Bank and have been since day one of the occupation. That's not a response. In fact, we know that the result of the rocket fire isn't to push the Israelis to get out of the West Bank. It's to make it impossible for them to get out of the West Bank, because then rockets from the West Bank could hit Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And since the Hamas people are smart, we have to assume the purpose of the rocket fire was to make withdrawal from the West Bank impossible, because Hamas doesn't want a mini state alongside of Israel. Hamas wants the whole thing. And that's not a just ambition. Back there.
My question is that after the 2006 invasion of Lebanon, after the Israeli army withdrew from Lebanon, the Hezbollah, they declared that we have won.
We have won.
They started celebrating. And the most recent, the attack on the Hamas after the Israeli army withdrew from the Gaza, the militants again fired rockets. And the head of Hamas, he lives in Syria, he went to Iran, and he also celebrated with the Iranian president and stuff. And my question is that it's like tit for tat action. They're throwing rockets and Israel is attacking. So how long will this thing go on, and when is there any peace? What is the permanent solution? And how long will people live in fear on both sides of the border?
Yes, we all know what the solution is. We just don't know how to get there. The solution is two states side by side, two sovereign states. The problem is how to get there, and it's a problem that involves, it involves major work on each side. It involves what you might call internal unilateralism. The Palestinians have to, first of all, end their civil war, and they have to recognize the state of Israel, and they have to repress their terrorist organizations. And the Israelis have to recognize the right of the Palestinians to a state of their own, and they have to begin the evacuation of the settlements. The nice thing about those two lists is that they can be done independently without any engagement of the two sides. Because if the Israelis can evacuate the settlements, move the settlers out and the army in until there is a partner on the other side, and the Palestinians can repress the terrorist organizations on their own, and it's not going to happen. I mean, no one is moving in this direction, but that's the kind of initiatives that would make it possible for the two sides then to negotiate a settlement. Okay, one more question. There's back here.
Hi, my name is David, and I'm an instructor over at the Army War College. And I would submit to you that what makes the answer to all of the questions you're posing rhetorically extremely difficult is you're fundamentally attempting to apply moral and ethical principles to something that is inherently unethical and immoral, which is the use of violence in an organized fashion to compel someone else to do what you want them to do. I would submit to you that inherently makes your questions almost unanswerable. However, I would further submit to you that what makes them answerable is, when you talk about proportionality, in essence what you're talking about is practicing restraint. And of course, there are many paradoxes in much of what you have discussed. One of those paradoxes is that the greater responsibility falls on the entity that has the greater ability to win or to exercise proportionality or to exercise restraint. But what I would further submit is maybe the better question than asking the moral and ethical question of what is a just war and what is proportionality is it fundamentally gets down to two pragmatic things, which is what can we live with that we're willing to do in terms of our conscience, the outcomes of things that are clearly highly regrettable, clearly horrendous in many cases, and clearly objectionable, all of which are tenets of warfare or extreme violence. And secondarily, we have to ask ourselves, what are the negative impacts of if we do not practice what we consider some subjective degree of proportionality in the form of, will we create more enemies than we defeated? Will world opinion turn against us? Will the folks that we're trying to fight, our adversaries, fight us harder? So I would submit to you the underlying thesis of the question you're asking is unanswerable when you pose it in a moral and ethical framework, because warfare is inherently immoral and unethical.
Okay, I hope that's not the doctrine that's being taught at the Army War College. But what you said contradicts your own argument. You said we have to decide what we can live with in our own consciences. But think about what a conscience is. The word comes from co-science. It means shared knowledge. And the original Protestant conception of conscience was it was knowledge shared with God. And the secular conception of conscience is it's knowledge shared with our fellow human beings. But in either case, since it is shared, it has to be talked about. We have to try to figure out what our consciences permit and what they don't permit. We have to have doctrines which we can argue and discuss and use in order to judge what we do and what other people do. And then once you start down that road, you get to just war theory.
Proportionate to how much danger we're in. In other words, what would be unjust if you were at the moment of defeat or of losing everything that you were fighting for? So quite frankly, we have applied different standards of violence, different standards of internment, to include in World War II in our own country, of interning U.S. citizens of other ethnic backgrounds. We've applied standards of morality and ethics quite differently throughout our history as Americans, and so have other advanced nations in the world, based on the conditions they were in at the time and the level of desperation that those conditions merited. So I would again say nothing of what you have answered of my question negates my premise that it's fundamentally a pragmatic question, not a moral and ethical one.
Well, pragmatism is a moral doctrine, in fact. That's the way it's taught in philosophy departments. In any case, of course, our danger is part of the moral argument. It's part of the moral calculation. Some of the things we do when we think we're in danger, we later decide, like the internment of Japanese Americans, was wrong. And when we decide that it's wrong and actually pay reparations to the families, that means we're going to try not to do that again. We're going to try to do it better next time. That's what these arguments, that's the point of these arguments. And the arguments are unavoidable. They go on continuously in all human conflict because we are moral creatures and we have a need to explain to ourselves and justify to ourselves what we do. And you would be doing that also. You would find yourself doing it, maybe using a language that you think is not moral, but which would be exactly parallel to the moral arguments that other people were making.
On behalf of the Clark Forum and the U.S. Army War College, I'd like to thank you all for your attendance, and that this concludes this evening's event.